Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Smith, Judge Larson, Judge Hooten, the Honorable Tracy M. Smith presiding.
Thank you. Good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. I apologize for our delay. We had a little over in our last case. So we're on our second case of our oral calendar this morning, which is A21-1433, State of Minnesota versus Kamar Anthony Hawkins. Counsel, as you well know, each of you has 15 minutes for your principal argument. State your name, the party you represent for the record. And counsel for appellant, you'll have 5 minutes rebuttal. And we are ready for counsel for appellant to start.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the court, Rachel Bond representing the appellant Kamar Hawkins. Hawkins was convicted of second-degree culpable negligence manslaughter after a jury trial in Ramsey County. And in this direct appeal from the judgment of conviction, we are asking this court to reverse the conviction because the state failed to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the victim's death was caused, either factually or legally, by means of Hawkins. Oh,
thank you.
Mr. Raggis points out. The
Marshall, you want, there we go. All right, thanks so much.
Because the state's evidence failed to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the victim's death was caused either factually or legally by means of Hawkins' culpably negligent act. That sufficiency of the evidence issue on causation actually entails three what I would think of as sub-issues, and I hope to address all of those this morning. Starting with cause in fact, factual cause is not something that comes up all that frequently in homicide cases. Usually it's quite clear what the cause of the death was. But in this case, it's front and center because of this unusual factual scenario where we have a lethal shot to the head undertaken by someone else who not acting in concert with Hawkins. And because of the plain language of the manslaughter statute that requires both conduct and a result that occurs because of that conduct. So to start with the question of what does the state have to prove for factual causation? As the court knows from my brief, I am relying on the plain language of the statute in conjunction with the United States Supreme Court's Barrage case to take the position that this statute requires but-for causation. And that is because, again, the manslaughter statute, as the court knows, makes it a crime to cause the death of another by any of the following means, and then the subdivision is, by means of culpable negligence. And that requires that the result, the death, be caused by means of the prohibited act. And that
And I know you talked about it in the proximate cause part of the argument, but if, say, someone was engaged, you know, someone shoots someone, there's a struggle for a gun, and then a lethal shot is done. So they're not acting in concert. If in this case there was a non-lethal shot, then there was a fight with a victim or with a third party, and that third party then, say, delivers the fatal shot. Is there causation in fact from a non-lethal shot by the wrongdoer here, but the lethal shot is delivered by someone in struggle with that person?
And the person in the struggle is not the victim, but is a third party.
Yeah, we'll make it a third party. He's standing right next to me, grabs a gun, he sees a shot, he grabs a gun to try and save the victim, accidentally shoots the victim. Is a non-lethal shot, when they're not in concert with each other, is that then not causation of fact? Even though it's proximate causation, I think you might have acknowledged, is there no causation in fact?
Well, no, I mean, not in that scenario that you just described. The causation in fact, I mean, I agree, part of that question sort of starts to bleed into the proximate cause, legal cause question. The cause in fact question really is about what the medical evidence is in the case. And that
Okay, so when is a non-lethal shot? Is it only but-for causation if it combines with another lethal shot to become lethal? Or I'm just trying to, it seems like otherwise a non-lethal shot, it would not be causation in fact in most cases then, right?
I think that would be a problem in most cases if the element is causing the death. That's sort of where we are. And so if there, I think what the case law, some of the case law and then some of the sort of secondary treatise authorities that I discussed talk about is if you have two lethal shots, then there's causation in fact. If you have two non-lethal shots, there might also be causation in fact, because there's not really a rational inference to support a theory of innocence. But here, and I think this aligns with your hypothetical.
Why would the causation in fact, I'm trying to understand why you said if they're acting in concert, you could have a non-lethal shot. If they're, as long as they're acting in concert, even if it's not the cause in fact, you know, the fatal shot is. Why would that be causation in fact as a statutory interpretation matter?
Well, I think we don't get there as a statutory interpretation matter. And again, one of the reasons that causation in fact and legal cause is so important in this case, and I think it's why we don't see it in other cases, is because if they, and by in concert with, I'm really using that shorthand for accomplice liability. If there's accomplice liability and person A and person B, or in this case, Mr. Hawkins and Quincy Adams are acting as accomplices, then they become legally liable for each other's conduct. And so in that scenario, Hawkins could, if they were accomplices, Hawkins could do a non-lethal shot. Quincy Adams could do a lethal shot, but Hawkins becomes legally liable for the death that was factually caused by Quincy's shot by virtue of accomplice liability. And it is one of the things that makes this case very different and unusual. And I, again, I think it's why you don't really see it, because usually we have, if there's two people, maybe you have felony murder, maybe you have accomplice liability, you don't usually have a third party responding to party one shooting party two when party one is not shooting at the third party. And that's what's going on in the moment of the culpably negligent act. Judge Hooten, did you have a question?
Can I ask you this? Because I mean, I'm looking at the Schwab rule, which is to sustain a conviction for second degree manslaughter, the act of the defendant must have been the proximate cause of the death of the victim without the intervention of an efficient independent force in which the defendant did not participate or which he could not have reasonably foreseen. As I understand, the arguments that were made by defense counsel was that this act of the other shooter, other than the defendant, was an independent force, and that argument actually was made to the jury. Well, the state said basically, look, if you fire the first shot at someone else who has a gun, and they start shooting, that's not an unforeseen act. That's a natural consequence of you starting with that first shot. And therefore, this defendant should be liable because these are all foreseen actions that would reasonably should have been foreseen by him when he fired that first shot. And that's what was argued to the jury. And the jury apparently accepted it. How is this not sufficient evidence under the Schwab rule?
And Judge Hooten, just so I can respond to the question you're asking, are you asking about cause and fact and why Schwab rules out my position?
Or
are
you asking about cause and fact, first of all? Yes.
Okay. So my answer to that, and this is one of the bases that this court in the non-precedential opinion of Bonacci-Kosky rejected this cause and fact argument, is that Schwab does not preclude this court interpreting the culpable negligence manslaughter to decide what is required for factual cause. Schaub was not a factual cause case. It was a proximate cause case. There's no question in Schaub about what caused the death. The explosion caused the death. The question is whether the defendant in that case was legally liable because his act of turning on the gas was the proximate cause of the death that ensued. So my first answer on this factual cause question is that Schaub, again, predates Barrage, is not a statutory interpretation case, and is not a cause in fact case. So that I think Schaub does not answer the question presented here, as to the cause in fact. If I might just make a quick jump to proximate cause under Schaub, because I think that is also, and if the court finds no cause in fact, either under my interpretation of the statute, which requires but-for cause, or frankly, even under a cause in fact requirement that is substantial causal factor, then we don't have to get to legal cause, right? You have to prove cause in fact first before you get to legal cause.
And if to just before, I know you want to turn to that, but just to clarify then, there's no published case law in Minnesota that would hold that cause in fact is required under the statute at this time. Is this the first time that we would be at a, or are you saying the Supreme Court has somehow said that or that we have said that in a published case?
This court has said that in Hawkins, the published case, which is a culpable negligence manslaughter. I mean, it's probably not fair to characterize it as a holding, but the discussion of the court in that case says, and that's, I think it's Hawkins, it's the deer stand one. The court in that case says it requires both factual cause and legal cause. I don't think there's any big dispute that you have to have factual cause and legal cause. I think the dispute between respondent and myself is what is required to show factual cause. Is it but for cause, or is it just this substantial causal factor that the case law tends to be concerned about? So I don't think there's much dispute that you have to have factual cause. And in a case like this, where you have a second person engaging in conduct that causes an immediately lethal headshot, then for sure we've got to figure out cause in fact. So that's my position on the factual cause. Turning then to the question if we get to legal cause and proximate cause. And that's the standard in Schaub that Judge Hooten related. And that's the question of why isn't this a natural and probable consequence that someone would fire a gun if they are being fired upon? That's the question I heard from the court. And that's how opposing counsel sets it out in his brief. And that requires a more precise identification of what the facts are of the offense. And that's where it becomes so relevant that this is not a case where person A is shooting at person B and person B returns fire and hits person C. The moment of the culpable negligent act is person A firing at person B. Person C sees that, panics, and starts to fire at person A. And that is criminal conduct. Make no mistake, there's no basis to say that was self-defense or defense of others, because Quincy Adams testified and the evidence showed that he pled guilty to culpable negligence manslaughter. So when I look at the case law, I say, what are the circumstances under which Minnesota courts have found something to be a natural and probable consequence of an act? Well, if it's the victim himself, if the victim grabs the gun, if the victim has an underlying medical condition, that certainly is part of the natural consequence that is probably set in motion by the original act. If I think two people are shooting at each other, then I suppose it probably makes sense to say person A discharges the gun. We've got guns out anyway. It might be a probable and natural result that person B is going to return fire. But that's not what happened. And the thing that troubles me a little bit about the state's position in this case is that I think this court is going to have to hold that that Hawkins, or a person in his position, is liable, criminally liable, for all the reactions that other people take upon seeing someone be shot. And that to me is a little bit troubling to say that's something that we are going to hold Hawkins responsible for and under proximate cause.
You know, in your scenario, though, I mean, it's undisputed, though, isn't it, that the other shooter was actually shooting at Hawkins. He just happened to be a bad shot, and he shot the victim again. This isn't where he's independently trying to kill the victim. that doesn't appear to be any, there is no fact supporting that. Doesn't this fall within the natural consequence that if someone starts shooting, that you can expect that the other person with the gun who will start defending his friend and shoot back?
Well, again, I don't see any basis in the case law for that. I see the case law drawing lines in a lot of places. And one is, if the victim himself is returning fire, fine, maybe. If there's something about the victim's physical condition, fine. But again, Hawkins did not shoot at Quincy Adams. So the state's position in this immediate scenario of when the victim's death was caused, right? The state's position is Hawkins was firing and Quincy returned fire, and that's a probable consequence. But the problem is that Hawkins was not firing at Quincy Adams. The act that Hawkins took was firing at the victim. And I don't see any basis in the law or frankly in policy to say that A shoots B and it is natural and probable that C is gonna see that and start shooting and the original person is responsible for that.
Go ahead, Judge Larson, sorry.
I mean, factually here though, isn't it that there were two groups who were in a conflict with one another without guns? I feel like you're really narrowly reading the scope of the facts here to just the point when, your client pulled out his gun. But if you're looking at the totality of the facts in this case, there was a altercation that was happening between two groups of individuals. And then Mr. Hawkins, and there's one gun on either side. And I guess I don't understand the support that you have for sort of reading the facts in this case outside of that context, because I think that you have to get to your interpretation of the facts, that there's sort of this independent action of Mr. Hawkins shooting the victim, and then there's a separate independent act that resulted in the other gunshot wound.
The reason I'm doing that, Your Honor, is because that's what the statute requires. So if we were challenging sufficiency of causation on had the jury convicted my client of an intentional killing, of a depraved mind killing, any of those other things, then all of those facts of the broader scenario might be relevant to that decision. But the manslaughter...
But the jury convicted him of negligent killing. And my understanding of the way the state phrased that to the court was, you're in the middle of the dispute and you're the person who pulls a gun first. They're in the middle of a fight. There is, the natural reaction of that is if there's a gun on the other side, that gun is also going to be pulled. And I guess I don't, it's not clear to me from the language of the statute why we have to so narrowly look at the facts in this case.
Again, the statute, what Hawkins was convicted of was causing a death by means of culpable negligence. And the culpably negligent act was shooting at the victim in the back. So that's why I'm focusing it so narrowly, is because that was the element. And there's no question that that was the only thing for this count that gave rise, that was the only conduct at issue that was negligent. And so the statute requires that act, that negligent act, cause the death by means of the act itself. So that's why the focus is so narrow.
So would your argument be different if he had pulled a gun and shot it in the general direction of the other group?
So if Hawkins had shot a general shot in the direction of the other group, but we still have this other, we still have a reaction from Quincy that causes immediately lethal headshot. No, my argument would be the same, that whether it's the shot directly to the back or the shot in the general direction of the group, The state did not prove, because there remains a reasonable inference from these facts, that that conduct, that act of the shot, was not the but-for cause, a substantial causal factor in the death that resulted by means of Hawkins' shot.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You'll have time for rebuttal as well. Counsel for respondent. There you go.
I unmuted myself and then I muted myself again. Sorry about that. Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Thomas Raggetts. I'm an assistant Ramsey County attorney, and I represent respondent state of Minnesota in this matter. I think this case mainly comes down to two questions. Was appellant responsible for the death here? And then was Quincy's action a superseding cause that would eliminate that responsibility? And I'd like to start with the superseding cause question first, because it's fairly straightforward and simple. Appellant correctly notes on page 30 of his brief that a superseding cause must not have been brought about by the original negligence. Now here, of course, you have to look at the facts in the light most favorable to the verdict. And what Quincy testified was, is that he just returned fire. He only shot after being shot at first. So it's clear that Quincy's gunshots, one of which unfortunately hit his cousin in the head, killing him, were brought about by appellant's original negligence, by that original gunfire from appellant. So clearly we do not have a superseding cause here, because the gunshots from Quincy were brought about by appellant's actions. So then the slightly more complicated question is whether Quincy's gunshots were a natural and probable consequence of appellant shooting first, or more precisely, is there sufficient evidence to support the jury's verdict concluding that this was a natural and probable consequence? No case law supports appellant's argument that this isn't a natural and probable consequence. Now, appellant will say no case law supports my argument, but it's hardly surprising that there aren't any cases here with identical facts to these. I mean, as appellant notes, this is an unusual scenario. But if you look at the principles of causation, they do not support overturning the jury's verdict. Again, clearly we do not have a superseding cause here.
What if, let me just ask, what does it matter that it wasn't self-defense? What is that?
Well, Quincy testified that he was acting in self-defense, and appellant said at one point, at least, if the victim had been returning fire, that would be one thing, but it's different here because appellant was not shooting at Quincy, he was shooting at the victim. But that's not factually correct. If you look at page 978 of the transcript, appellant Quincy says, quote, he was shooting at me, unquote. So appellant was shooting at Quincy, and Quincy returned fire. Now, he may have done so in a negligent fashion. We don't know why he pled guilty. We don't have a transcript of his guilty plea, but you have to look at the facts in the light most favorable to the state. That cannot be disputed here. And Quincy clearly said, he was shooting at me, I just returned fire. Appellant shot first, Quincy shot back, because appellant was shooting at him, not just at Quincy's cousin who ended up dead.
So that sort of goes to my next question then. I assume the theory of the state's case then and the application of the statute is it wouldn't matter if the victim in this case had received a non-lethal shot. The question is, was a shot fired that prompted a second shot that resulted in someone's death? So that if there's, you know, person D out there who was walking down the sidewalk, you know, we have the exact same facts, except the lethal shot went to a completely unrelated person, not to the victim here. That would still be, a supportable violation of the statute?
I think it would, but I think the facts here are even stronger than that, because the other key fact here is that according to appellant's own testimony, he knew Quincy had a gun before he got his own gun and shot at Quincy. So even if it might not be natural and probable or foreseeable that some random person on the street is going to shoot at you if you shoot at someone else,
No, I don't mean a random person on the street. I'm saying the identical facts. When Quincy didn't hit the victim, he hit someone walking down the street. The lethal shot was delivered, and the trial is of whether that's a manslaughter against Hawkins, because he fired a shot that Quincy then returned, but then shot another, killed another person.
Yeah, I don't think it matters who ended up being killed, as long as the return fire was a natural, probable, foreseeable consequence. And certainly when you shoot at people, it is foreseeable that someone will shoot back, particularly in a case like this, where you know one of the people who you are shooting directly at has a gun. I mean, how can it not be foreseeable that that person's going to use that gun? And appellant has essentially conceded that, well, if Quincy had tried to grab his gun and then the gun had gone off and killed the victim, then maybe that would be okay. But I don't see any basis in the case law for drawing a line like that. Why is grabbing appellant's gun sufficient, but grabbing his own gun when he wasn't close enough to grab appellant's gun, not sufficient? I mean, splitting that kind of hair doesn't make any sense. The question is just, is it natural and probable and not something that was completely random and unforeseeable? And the jury found that here, and there's no basis for overturning it. If you look at the Frost case that appellant cites, Frost says that the shooter should have been aware of the risk that the victim would defend himself. Well, here too, appellant should have been aware of the risk that Quincy would use his gun that appellant knew he had to shoot back at him after he shot, not just at the victim, but at Quincy. So when you look at those facts in the light most favorable to state, I don't see how you can say this wasn't but for causation, if you even need to say that. I mean, this a panel of this court rejected that argument fairly recently. It's a convincing unpublished decision, and said you just need proximate cause, but you don't need to reach that here, because whether it's proximate cause or but for causation, it couldn't be more clear here that Quincy would not have shot except for the fact that he was being shot at by appellant. So that, if that's not but for causation, I don't know what ever could be. And therefore, you don't need to reach the issue of whether the shot to the back was also a lethal shot. I mean, the doctor said it would have killed him, but for fairly immediate medical intervention. And even then, it might have killed him. But we don't need to get to that, because we know the shot to the head was fatal. And we know that it wouldn't have occurred but for appellant shooting first at Quincy, who had a gun and who appellant knew had a gun. Now, appellant says, well, it's troubling to say if you start shooting, you're responsible for all the consequences of that. But you're only responsible for the natural and probable consequences. So if you shoot at someone in the woods and you have no idea anybody else is around, and then it happens there's a hunter 100 yards away who shoots at you and hits somebody else, well, maybe that wouldn't be natural and probable. But if you shoot at people and you know one of them has a gun, it shouldn't be troubling to hold you responsible for what happens for that. I mean, we want to deter people from shooting in crowded areas or at other people. And so there's no problem legally with what the jury did here. And there's no sort of opening of a can of worms we don't want to get into or creating too broad consequences. I mean, in this case, if Quincy had completely missed the victim and the victim hadn't died somehow, appellant would still be guilty of first-degree assault at a minimum for shooting the victim in the back. So appellant's clearly guilty of criminal conduct here. And he only got a 48-month sentence, by the way. So this isn't one of those cases, perhaps like a felony murder case, where there are troubling implications of holding people responsible for too many consequences that they couldn't have foreseen. Here we have natural and probable consequences. I think, looking over my notes, there isn't really anything else I want to say. Unless this court has questions, I'll simply ask that you affirm the jury's verdict. Thank you.
Rebuttal?
Thank you, Your Honor. I have three or four points to make. Let me start with that policy argument that opposing counsel made that, you know, clearly Mr. Hawkins has to be guilty of something here. The fact that the only charge that is left in this case is culpable negligence manslaughter, which requires causation, is a function of the charging decisions that the prosecutor made and the decisions that the jury made as far as what was proven beyond a reasonable doubt. I do not dispute that had first degree assault been submitted to the jury and that was it, we would have a guilty verdict and we would have a much longer sentence. But the prosecutor chose to bring a lot of charges and a lot of charges involving complicated causation issues. And the jury rejected enormous parts of the state's case.
Was first degree assault then, was it charged and submitted?
Charged and acquitted.
And acquitted on first
acquitted.
Degree
assault. Acquitted. Yep. So, speculation here, you know, my take is that the jury was a little overwhelmed with the charges and the elements. And once they rejected intentional killing and once they rejected depraved mind killing, then they kind of split the difference. And my guess is that the jury thought that manslaughter was the more serious charge than first degree assault. So I want to be very clear that, you know, the fact that there is one conviction left is really kind of irrelevant for this court's decision, right? There are a lot of different ways that this could have been charged. And I think that different results could have happened had the jury believed more of the state's case and had maybe fewer charges to have to consider. Quincy's testimony on opposing counsel referenced page 978 of the transcript and Quincy was returning fire. And I agree that, so when you read Quincy's testimony, there are sort of two parts of this altercation once my client is involved. And one is described in page 978, where according to Quincy's testimony, my client fires first and Quincy returns fire. No question about that. Quincy is running away then and turns around and looks back and sees my client shooting the victim. So again, at the point of the culpably negligent act, and we're talking about what was the act that my client did and what are the natural and probable consequences that flow from it. It is not at that point he takes the act of the shot towards the victim. He is not shooting towards Quincy. There is no exchange of gunfire between Hawkins and Quincy at that time.
How much time is in between him firing at Quincy and shooting the victim? Is that evident from the transcript?
I think not very much. I mean, I think it all happens pretty fast.
I'm just wondering whether one's mind is, oh, he was previously shooting at me, but now he's shooting at him. I'm in the clear and now I'm responding only to that. You know, if it sounds like this was...
Oh, I think it... So I think that a fair reading of the transcript is this all happened very fast. I don't know, within a minute or two. But Quincy's testimony is actually very clear about the purpose that he fires the shot that kills his cousin, which is he turns around, he sees my client shooting the victim, he panics, he says, I panicked and I shot at Hawkins. So he is not saying I panicked because I thought I might be next. He is doing it to stop Hawkins' conduct. I think that is very clear under the entirety of the transcripts. This question about, you know, what order should the court approach these issues in and what do you or don't you need to concede? I mean, it doesn't make much sense to me to go to superseding cause first. That's the last step in the analysis. I think probably the causation in fact is perhaps the hardest place for the state. And maybe that's why we want to jump to the end. I think the only analytically proper way to approach a causation case like this is, was there cause in fact? If no, under either standard, but for or substantial factor, then the conviction is reversed. If the court finds cause in fact, then you have to determine proximate cause. If you determine Quincy's conduct was an intervening cause for which he's, you know, then you get to the superseding last. So I don't see any way for this court to avoid that cause in fact question. And that turns on the medical evidence, the entirety.
Why is that? That's what I was just going to ask. I think the state is arguing, no, it is cause in fact.
Why is there not cause in fact?
Right. I mean, the state is saying there is cause and fact, I think. I think they're saying it's both. And you're saying, no, the only way there's cause and fact is when we're talking about a medical cause and fact. It seems to be a difference in terms of what,
you know, I
think that analytical approach, or is it what constitutes cause? I'm trying to understand that difference.
You know, my reading of the law is that when we are talking about cause and fact, we are talking about what is the thing that resulted in the death. And that, so that could be in Schaub, it was the explosion. In this case, it is a series of gunshot wounds. So that, I think, I don't know any case that on cause and fact starts bringing in legal causation concepts of proximate cause. And again, the court does, it's not usually an issue because usually it's very clear. But it's not in this case, and I know I'm out of time, I'll wrap up my answer. Because again, we've got these multiple gunshots that are not the same. They are not the same in their immediacy of death. And that creates, in a circumstantial evidence case, a reasonable inference that it was Quincy shot and Quincy shot alone that was the cause in fact of death.
Thank you. Thank you both for your arguments. The case is submitted. We'll have a decision out in a statutory time period. And that concludes our oral calendar, and we'll retire to consider our non-oral. Thank you.